On a summer morning in July in the year of 2011, I began a journey that in some regard continues until this very day. It wasn't the very beginning of the journey that continues until this very day, but it was the beginning of a chapter of a journey in my life that is one of real significance that continues to pay a positive, loving dividend into my life here as rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I pulled out of my driveway in Los Angeles long before the sun came up, and I headed north to this place. I thought that it was likely that I would spend the night, you know, somewhere around Park City or Evanston, find a campsite that I could pull into, get a few hours of sleep before I rolled into Jackson the next day. And I had plenty of food for dinner and for breakfast, but on the road in between Park City and Evanston, I just had so much energy to get to this place. This place was a very important place for my heart and for my rest. And I was coming to stay at the home of my surrogate parents, who many of you know well, Rob and Anna Mae Cass. But I wasn't coming to spend time with Rob and Anna Mae. I was coming to meet my friend Billy Gammon. Billy is probably today somewhere around 75 years old, and he and I met the year after I graduated from graduate school. When I finished seminary in Virginia, the bishop of the Diocese of Texas, who I owed a few years of service, sent me back to the city of Austin, where I would become the campus missioner, the Episcopal campus missioner at the University of Texas, which is where I did my undergraduate degree. And a few days after I landed in Austin, waiting for furniture and boxes to come to our new home, I received a call from the Bishop of Texas, Claude Payne. And Claude said, "Jimmy, I would like you to call a local Austin businessman and Episcopalian and leader in our diocese, Billy Gammon. I'd like you to set up a lunch and go to Billy and spend some time with him and get to know him. And I have told Billy that it is his job to teach you how to raise money from wealthy Episcopalians." It was a skill set that I did not yet have that I could imagine, of course, could come in handy in a career as an Episcopal priest. And so I called Billy, and we met for lunch one day, and we struck up a friendship, and we are still friends today. In 2011, sometime, probably about this time of year, I got a call from Billy in my office in Santa Monica. I had since finished my tenure at the University of Texas and moved to the city of Los Angeles and spent 5 years serving a large Episcopal parish there. And then at this moment in time, 2011, I was in kind of a funky Episcopal church startup called Thads. And Billy called me in my office one day and he said, "Hey, Jimmy, it's Billy. I was just calling to let you know that I need you to meet me in Jackson Hole, Wyoming on July 24th, and you and I are going to climb the Grand Teton together." My immediate response was like, "Oh, Billy, man, I would love to do that. But I need to tell you that I have hung up my climbing harness for good." A few years earlier, I had had a terrifying and unsuccessful attempt to summit the Grand Teton with another friend of mine. And coming down off that mountain on that particular day, I had made a decision in my life of like, well, I am many things, but what I am not is a mountaineer. And when I got back down to the valley, I remember seeing my wife, Cindy, in Robin Anime's driveway with our son, Jas, on her hip. I mean, it's one of those things that's just like seared into your memory. And Cindy was like, oh, I'm so glad you got home safely. Like, we were so worried about it. There was so much weather up there. I was like, yeah, tell me about it. Because that night, the wind howled like a freight train through the Jackson Hole Mountain Guide's high camp up there in the Tetons. And coming down, I had decided that I was no longer going to attempt mountaineering, but rather I would focus on hiking and fly fishing and doing the other things that so many of us love to do around this place. And I received this call from Billy. And Billy is one of those friends who's just like, I mean, you can say no to him, but it's very, very hard to say no to him. And I said, Billy, it's just not me. It's not something that I want to do. I tried it. And Billy said, look, I want you to know. And Billy, you know, at this time, he was probably maybe 62 years old, something like that, living near sea level at Austin, and I was living near sea level in Los Angeles. And he was like, look, I struggle with altitude. It's just a thing. And I've tried to climb the Grand 4 times, and I haven't gotten up there. But I am going to climb the Grand, and we're going to get to the top, and you're coming with me. And I, like, in a moment of, like, weakness, I was like, okay. And then I remember going home and telling Cindy, like, hey, I talked to Billy Gammon today, and I'm going to go up to Jackson and climb the Grand with him in July. And she was like, wait, what? What? And I was like, I know. But I'm going to try it. And so I left my driveway long before the sun came up, and I drove all the way to Jackson. I spent a couple nights at Rob and Anna May's house. I did what so many of you in the room have done. I got up early one morning. I grabbed Billy where he was staying. We went up to the Exum headquarters there adjacent Jenny Lake and looked at our gear and jumped on the boat and rowed across Jenny Lake and spent the day climbing up at Hidden Falls, practicing one with another with Mike Poborski, one of the Exum guides at the time, and then came back across the lake and had a little follow-up with Mike and said we would meet him at the trailhead the next morning, and that's what we did. We showed up with all the gear that we were supposed to have, and we began walking up to the lower saddle of the Grand Teton, a glorious place. And I can tell you, that's a stroll that so many people in our community take day after day in the summertime here. And we have become accustomed to that around this place, living in this particular context. But coming from Los Angeles, where I love to surf and could barely hike, it was an enormous adventure to undertake just to get up to the lower saddle, something that I had done once before in my lifetime and honestly really wasn't looking forward to at all. But we did what you do. One footfall after another footfall after another footfall after another footfall. And ultimately, we wound up on the lower saddle, there feasting our eyes on the glorious accommodation of the Exum Quonset Hut, where you are stuffed into that hut with 40 other weekend warrior adventurers, sawing logs at altitude, semi-nauseous at night, trying to put enough food in your belly that you have enough energy to keep your muscles moving, but really not feeling like you want to eat or drink anything at all. You get a little bit of sleep, And then the alarm goes off, right? You have been there. Many of you have been there. Somewhere around 3:30 in the morning, the alarm goes off, and then this becomes your world. All of you move through the next several hours. All of us move through the next several hours like this. This lamp enlightens the dehydrated oatmeal that you put water in, that you rehydrate, sort of, that goes back into your stomach and then dehydrates your stomach. Maybe you scarf down a couple of Pop-Tarts nervously. You put on a few too many layers of clothes that after walking for 5 or 6 minutes, you have to stop and strip down because the idea of starting cold when you're trying to summit a mountain that you really don't want to summit feels like really bad, but you do it nevertheless and you keep walking. And all that you see is what this light brings to your perspective. And that's just it for several hours, depending upon where you are and in the traffic jam that can become the Grand Teton on a July Alpine start morning. You can see these things. You can look down and see the climbers coming up from Jackson Hole Mountain Guides camp. You can look further down and see those intrepid souls who one day the grand, like my daughter Jade, those crazy people who try to do that and then do it in just one day a little bit further down. And usually there's a group or two ahead of you. But all you see in front of you for hours is this. It's just what this headlamp can enlighten. So you really don't have a sense of where you are other than moving one or two or three paces ahead of you, or perhaps your guide or your companion. Mine, Billy's headlamp, enlightens a particular perspective that you catch a glimpse of. But for the most part, this is all you see for hours. For two-thirds, for three-quarters of the climb, you don't see any more of the Grand Teton, or for that matter, any of the Tetons, except for the granite that is about 5 feet in front of your face. That's it. That's it. This morning, the second Sunday of Lent delivers us a portion of a beautiful story. It's not the very beginning of the story, but it is the beginning of a chapter in this guy Abram, or Abraham's life. We get this little interlude, this taste from the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis. And really, to have a wider view of this story, to know of its gravity and its importance in the life of a Jewish Christian person, we need to go back three chapters. We need to look at the 12th chapter of Genesis, where God strikes up a conversation with Abraham and puts into his mind this idea. God says to Abraham, "Abraham, you are my guy. You are the one that I have picked out to begin an enormously gorgeous, powerful story. You are the one who will be the first one of so many. And in order for you to embody this story that I have for you, I'm going to take you away from everything you know except for a few members of your family. You are going to have to leave the place that you know and call home in order ultimately for your people to occupy and embody life in a place that I have picked out for you." God tells Abraham that his progeny will be more numerous than the stars in the sky. And that sets about, that kicks off a both quizzical and comical adventure. We don't really read it that way because the institution is so domesticated, the story itself, but the details are important, and we can rewild the story if we pay attention to those details. In the 12th chapter of Genesis, when God comes to Abraham and says, "Abraham, you will leave all the good order that you know and be thrust into the chaos of the wilderness so that your family and your name will become bigger and brighter than you can even imagine." At that point in time, Abraham is 75. 75 with no kids. No kids from his wife, Sarah. And then in that moment, Abraham, for some reason, has the courage to be responsive to that call. And he and his wife, Sarah, and then like somewhat quizzically and comically too, like his brother's kid, Lot. You know, it's the three of them along with all of their entourage, but it's sort of like, I don't know, like, how did Lot get in there? Like, his brother was like, "Man, Lot's kind of like underperforming here. He needs a job. Like, can you take him? Can you take him and help him?" And then that kicks off this moment where they leave, and they leave with everything they have. And then in the very next chapter, you find that, like, Lot's shepherds and Abraham's shepherds are not really getting along very well. They're fighting and being nasty one to another. So Abraham and Lot have to do this thing of like, "Well, look, this isn't really working out. Like, maybe I go left and you go right for a time, and then we'll see if we can't come back together. But this, Lot, this really isn't working." And then Lot goes off on his own, and where Lot picks off to go off on his own happens to be this place where four kings are fighting five kings, and Lot gets conquered, and all of his people and all of his sheep get subsumed into this conquering army. This is all in one chapter. And then Abraham's like, "Oh gosh, I guess I got to go back and rescue my nephew." And he goes back and he rescues Lot and brings him back into the fold. And it is in this glorious moment that we have the beginning of the 15th chapter of Genesis, the reading that we have today, which, you know, says like God came to Abraham in a vision, like it's a dream. Now, this is the first moment where God comes to Abraham in a vision, and it's this first like sort of like supportive moment. It's the first of many supportive moments that God has with Abraham over the course of Abraham's wildly creative but utterly chaotic life. He comes to him and he says like, "Hey, Abraham, a deal's a deal. I'm still here. It's the same thing. You and everyone who comes after you will be more numerous than the stars in the heaven, I promise." It's the very beginning of this powerful phrase that comes from the Hebrew scriptures that narrates Abraham's life. And if Abraham's life, then your life and my life too. This wonderful line that is one of two things that I've considered getting tattooed onto my body, with the exception of an unfortunate orange longhorn. It's this powerful line that's so central to my faith, and I want it to be central to yours too. It's this powerful line that reads, "Lo, I am with you always." God with Abraham in the goodness and the order of the promise of the deal that they strike one with another and God with Abraham in the midst of the chaotic wilderness where he finds himself for much of his life. It is a beautiful story where goodness and chaos are braided together, and yet God is with Abraham always. Abraham, moving out in faith, embodying the life that he was built for and the promise that was delivered to him in a courageous way. If we were to ask ourselves what it is that Abraham is doing, I could use a religious word for it, and I'm going to. It's an important word, and it needs some explanation here, and I'm going to say it, and then you're going to think something, and I want to disavow you of that thinking. What Abraham is doing in this moment in time is embodying faith. He is living a faithful life. But for those of us who have been enculturated, raised, protected, nurtured, challenged in this environment where the Enlightenment like delivers so much emphasis on what we think, we have come to understand faith as like a number of bullet points, as like dogmatic comments. And we go and we pick the ones that mean something to us, maybe not dissimilar from what people were doing when they were assembling the Nicene Creed. You love the Nicene Creed, right? All Episcopalians do. No Episcopalians love the Nicene Creed. They're all like, I don't know why we say this thing in church when like half of these things I don't believe, but then I literally say that I believe them. And it's like, yeah, because it's not about that. It's not like faith is not conceptual. It's not something that we think about and we subscribe to intellectually. Don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we check our brains at the door. I'm just saying like when we execute a faithful life, it's like doing what Abraham did. It's really living, even though the life that is before us is chaotic. Abraham, for the vast majority of his life, from the very beginning to the end of that story in the scriptures, all he can see is 5 feet in front of him. Abraham has a headlamp and a promise, and that's it. That's all he has. And yet, he makes one footfall after another footfall after another footfall until there are moments in time when the sun rises and you get a glimpse of the glory and the magnitude of the beauty of the cosmos that we find ourselves in, that we make our way through. If you were around church last Sunday, you know that our Lenten theme for this year is vision. And we've divided that visionary practice into 3 parts, using some, you know, playing with it a bit. Microscope, telescope, kaleidoscope. The microscope being that part of the discipline of visioning or revisioning or reconnecting to vision that is internal, that is about insight and introspection. We get down to see the details that are on the inside. And then telescope, right? This idea of like we put ourselves, we get a vision for ourselves in a particular context. We zoom out from the relatively small details and particularities of our own life, and we see, like, here we sit as a creature, an ant, a grain of sand in this glorious cosmos that is so dynamic and so beautiful and so chaotic that we can't even understand. The magnitude is so big that we might even become frightened in that moment, anxious. And then we go to the kaleidoscope to pull us out of that anxiety, where we have a particular perspective, where there is play on our own visual perspective, so that we might see beauty, we might see goodness, we might understand how we fit in to this particular moment in time. And if you were around this church last week, you heard me connect two pieces of scripture together. One that we heard, that we always hear on the first Sunday in Lent, with the scene that comes right before that. The first Sunday of Lent, all the time, delivers us Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. It's not his temptation in the wilderness. It's not. That's the wrong title. Just mark it out of your Bible when you get home. That story doesn't begin in the wilderness. That story begins in the river. It begins in the Jordan River when John the Baptist baptizes Jesus, and we hear that those words from heaven, "This is my child, chosen and marked by my love, the delight of my life." And it is then, from that place, from that very place, where Jesus, and if Jesus, then you and I, chosen and marked by God's love, the delight of God's life, it is from that place that Jesus is driven back out into the chaos of everyday life, the wilderness, where he finds himself tempted by Satan. Not tempted toward disobedience or breaking the rules. That's such a, like, elementary school way of seeing the story that it just drives me crazy. That's not it. It's not about being good or being bad, y'all. It's just about being who we were made to be, which is children chosen and marked by God's love, the very delight of God's life. And then Jesus pushed out into the wilderness to see if he could, to see if he could live the way in which he was built to live, rather than be distracted by the things that draw him fearfully away from it, right? Faith is not about believing some concepts. Faith looks more like courage than anything else. Just being able to take action in the face of fear. But it's not just courage, right? It's courage that is attached to a relationship. So faith looks like this for us. It looks like you are God's child, chosen, marked by God's love, the very delight of God's life. Oh, and I know. Things fall apart. Things interrupt. Bad stuff happens. Confusing things draw us away from that. And so then, there is this reminder, especially when we are in those places of darkness and chaos. Low. Who says low anymore? I do. You do. Low. Nevertheless, I am with you.